you would, turn over in your Bibles over to 2 Kings. And if you want to put one finger there and a second finger over in, I think it's 1 Chronicles. Tonight we're going to kind of do a history lesson and see what kind of things we can learn from what I'm calling the divided kings. In essence, the kings from the divided kingdom period in Jewish history. For just kind of a brief orientation of where we are. Of course, as you remember, as you know, Moses brought the Israelites out of the wilderness to the edge of the promised land. Joshua then took over. And then Joshua died, the generation that died. And then a new generation arose that didn't remember all of that. And then you get into the time of the judges that was really, I don't know what to call it. Not necessarily a downward spiral, but it was up and it was down, it was up, it was down, it was up, it was down, etc. Until the people finally petitioned Samuel for a king instead of God as their king, if you remember that. And so they got a king. King Saul first reigned for, I think, about 40 years, if I remember right. Of course, he was replaced by David. And David, about 40 years, and eventually he was replaced, I say replaced, succeeded by his son Solomon. And then we're kind of going into the time period we want to talk about tonight, which will pretty much cover the united kingdom, or the kingdom that had been united under Saul and David and Solomon, getting split, and eventually the northern kingdom going into captivity by the Assyrians around 720 BC, followed by the southern kingdom going into Babylonian captivity around 580 and change. So we'll be kind of looking at the various kings and queen during this time period and seeing what kind of lessons we can get. So it's partially historical overview, but it's also things that we can learn from their good and not so good examples. Roughly 400 years, and again, from the beginnings of the divided kingdom through the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. 1 Kings beginning roughly chapter 12, and 2 Chronicles beginning roughly chapter 10. They are the two main sections in the Bible that cover this time period. Roughly 20 kings in the north, 20 kings in the south, give or take, and one queen, by exception, in the southern kingdom. And you kind of just reading, I mean, I understand the Old Testament is only kind of hitting the highlights as it's going along, but I often get the impression, you know, not a very stable time period. Now, maybe the stable time periods, they tend to just zip over and go on to the next trauma, so to speak. But you get the impression, very unstable. I mean, from a political perspective, I mean, all kinds of assassinations going on, civil war, local threats from the various pagan nations around about them. Global threats from, you know, large dominant regional powers, you know, Syria early on, and of course later on Assyria, and finally Babylon. Not only political instability, but also religious instability. Just an ongoing conflict or tug of war, so to speak, between worshiping, you know, true God, you know, temple sacrifices, etc., and worshiping, you know, the Baal and the Ashtoreths and Chemosh and Milcom and all those kind of pagan idol gods. And it's like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I mean, one king comes up and he wants to do what's right. And of course, they do what's right and they get rid of all the pagan stuff for a while. And the next king comes up, or king afterwards comes up and says, yep, I want to do the pagan stuff. And so they switch over to that. And they get rid of the, you know, temple worship and whatever, and they bring all the idols back. And then another king switches back, another king. I mean, it's a little bit like the current political situation in the United States with, you know, the Democrats and Republican to a degree. I mean, it's not like the Democrats come into power and all of the Republican cities or Republican capitals, whatever, are, you know, burned and destroyed and the people are killed. And then the Republicans come into power and then all the Democratic cities and places of entertainment and worship, whatever, are, you know, destroyed and killed. It's not like that. At this time, it was in Old Testament history. So keep that in mind as we kind of grow through this. Now, I found this chart on the internet. Do not try to read the words. I know you can't, unless you're on the front row. But it wasn't necessarily included here for reading purposes, but more for graphical visualization purposes. Let me kind of orient you real quick. So basically, this is the list of the kings of Judah on the left, and southern kingdom, Judah, on the left, and the kings of Israel, or the northern kingdom, on the right. Okay. And what they've done is they've color-coded it. So kings that tended to, quote-unquote, do what was right inside the Lord are color-coded green. Those that, quote, did evil are color-coded kind of pinkish. It's red on the monitor, but anyway, kind of pinkish. And those that were kind of partially good, partially bad, were kind of color-coded yellow. So at a glance, a couple different things come visually to the forefront. One is, in terms of the kingdom of Israel, you know, once they split up, bad, semi-bad. And in the context of bad, predominantly idol worship, etc. And we'll talk some about that tonight as well. And of course, going off into, you know, Syrian captivity here, roughly, again, 720, give or take, BC. On the other side, left side, southern kingdom, kingdom of Judah, again, it's like back and forth. It's seesaw, it's teeter-totter, oscillating, whatever term you want to use. You know, with some bad, some good, some bad, some eh, some good, some bad, some good, some bad, some good, bad. If you kind of squint a little bit, yeah, it is a mix. One thing, this is a little misleading. In some ways, it is kind of chronological, but the it's not proportionate to the number of years. Basically, they reserve, you know, so much height here in each cell for each person, whether they reign for, you know, 20 years or 2 years, whatever. So it's a little misleading from that perspective. But the main message is Northern Kingdom, sadly, once they divided off, went into idolatry permanently until they were taken away by the Assyrians. Southern Kingdom, back and forth. Okay, so here's another graph, and this one we are going to use quite a bit. So let me orient you to it. Over on the left, Southern Kingdom, Kingdom of Judah, typically, notionally, the lion associated with it. You know, starting off with Saul, and then eventually a change in regime over to David and his posterity down here to the bottom. Of course, down here to the bottom is when they go off into Babylonian captivity. Over here on the right side, you've got the Northern Kingdom, and this particular author chose a bull. I don't know if that's in relationship to the golden calves that were set up as idols. Anyway, starting off with Jeroboam, and then, you know, a number of different family lineages, so to speak, including some that kind of come close back and forth in terms of aligning and marriage, and we'll talk about that a little bit as well. And finally, they get, you know, taken away, last king with Hosea, again, roughly around 720. We'll use this as kind of an anchor graphic as we kind of go through each example to kind of give you a sense of, you know, where we are, so to speak, in the timeline. Okay, lots of lessons to learn. New Testament recognizes that. Romans chapter 15, verse 4 says, "For whatever was written in former times," of course, Old Testament, "was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures we might have hope." The other side of the coin, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6 and verse 11, "Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they're written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come." So in some ways, with this, these two particular verses in comparison, you know, good examples, encouraging good examples, etc. If I want to say discouraging examples or bad examples, you know, stay away. So, you know, model these, so to speak, stay away from those, so to speak. Lots of lessons to learn. Tonight I've got about a half a dozen. And depending upon what Alan wants to do when he comes back, we may come back with part two. So I can't say this is part one. Maybe it is part one. Anyway, off we go. So roughly around 960, give or take, BC, we start off with Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Solomon is dead, and the, you know, kingdom has been turned over to his son, Rehoboam. And now we're kind of going to watch what happens. So the first example we have is with Rehoboam in that time period. Now, If you're following along in the, by what we're going to do is I'm going to kind of give you the general context. And if you want to kind of skim through that context as I'm talking, feel free. 1 Kings chapter 12, give or take. The context is, this is early on in Rehoboam's reign. And many of the people from the nation have approached him, basically saying, hey, when your father was king, you know, we had to do a whole lot in terms of servitude, in terms of giving him stuff. In our modern vernacular, we might say they had a heavy tax load, and they approached him, and that should not have been a surprise, because that's exactly what I think it was Samuel predicted in 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 through 18. You say you want a king? Okay. If you want a king, this is what your king's going to be like. He's going to have you do this and this and this and this. Take your sons and take your daughters and take your livestock and your etc. And they say, we don't care, we still want a king. It's like, okay, you got what you asked for. Now they're saying, wait a minute. Taxes too heavy, for example. And so they approach Rehoboam and say, hey, please reduce our tax burden. So he consults with his father's counselors, and he consults with the guys he grew up with. And he chooses the guys he grew up with and their advice, as opposed to the others. Pretty much they said, you know, speak roughly to this people. It's like, hey, you thought my father was heavy with taxes? You just wait. You haven't seen nothing yet. And as you may recall the story, basically that just split the kingdom in half. Because the people said, hey, we've had enough of this business. You know, we don't have any sort of inheritance with the sons of Jesse, David, etc. You know, we're going to go off and do our own thing. Kingdom thrown in the Civil War. I have not added up the number of deaths that occurred in the years that followed, but I think it's easily hundreds of thousands of deaths resulting from that quote-unquote bad advice. So, what can we learn? How can we apply this? Well, I've come up with a few. One is, you know, is it good to seek counsel? Absolutely. I mean, the more consequential the decision is. I mean, if you're a young person and if you're, you know, contemplating a career, for example, or which, you know, university perhaps if you're going to go down that path to go to, or one job versus another job, or moving to another place, or selecting a congregation, or whatever the case may be, you know, it's good to seek counsel, right? I mean, that's what Proverbs 11:14 says. Multitude of counselors, there's safety. Proverbs 15:22, Proverbs 24:6, etc. And in a lot of cases, not necessarily in all cases, you know, with age should come wisdom. And so naturally you would tend to seek those that have been down the road before, logically. Job 32:7 carries that thought as well. Ultimately, though, where does wisdom come from? Of course, we've been studying that. Proverbs, right? In Carl's class, you know, Proverbs 2:6, for the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Of course, we understand that also includes God's word. And you would hope, you know, Rehoboam, of all people, would have learned that lesson, right? Solomon being his father. I got this quote from Ecclesiastes 7, written by Solomon, Ecclesiastes 7, 25. I directed my mind to know, to investigate, to seek wisdom and explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. Rehoboam didn't get that lesson. Hopefully we do. Rehoboam, bad advice. Okay? Let's talk about his counterpart, Jeroboam. Okay? Quote-unquote religious improvements. So contextually, same context in terms of 1 Kings, and now you've got Rehoboam, king over the southern kingdom, Jeroboam, you know, pretty much in charge of the northern kingdom, and now they're competing in some sense. Especially Jeroboam with the Israelites that are now in the northern part of the nation. And so Jeroboam has this concern that, well, you know, the more often these people go down to Jerusalem and associate with those people down there and offer sacrifices in the temple and go do the multi-annual feasts and whatever, you know, Rehoboam may just convince them to stay and they'll kill me. So, you know, he's in this dilemma. So what does he do? As you may recall the story, he's got a better idea. Okay? He's going to set up some centers of worship in Dan, which if I remember right is in the northern part, and Bethel, which is in the southern part. just north of Jerusalem. And I didn't check it on the map, but I've heard it's really not that far from Jerusalem. So if you're going all the way to Dan, if you're going all the way to Bethel, you know, it's just like a hop, skip, and a jump, you know, down a valley, a couple, whatever, and you're in Jerusalem. But what he said, what he told the people, I put this quote on the bottom, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Too hard, too inconvenient, whatever. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Golden calves. Of course, you remember that from going into the initial wilderness. And what wasn't good then, it wasn't good here. That's 1 Kings 12:28. That was just the beginning, though. Not only did he set up these two special worship centers, not only did he set up these two graven image golden calf idol things as an object of worship, but he also made shrines or places of worship on all the high places, made priests or selected priests from any tribe, not just the tribe of Levi, set up his own special feast days. And if I remember correctly, they weren't necessarily right on top of the ones in Jerusalem, but they were very close to it. Anyway, all for convenience, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what happened as a result? Well, I almost said good news. The plan succeeded. We have to at least admit that. So he lured the people. He succeeded in luring them away from Rehoboam, away from Jerusalem, away from the temple, away from worship of the true God. And as we'll see in some a little bit later examples, permanently. I mean, it worked real well. As we saw earlier with the northern kingdom going into idolatry permanently. Well, you can give Jeroboam the credit. Well, credit's a bad term. You can go back to Jeroboam and say, yeah, he started it. Of course, the people continued it. But in terms of its roots, Jeroboam, religious improvements. So what can we learn from that? Well, anytime we get attracted into either a religion or a religious practice or a religious denomination that tends to favor things of convenience or things that are easy or things that make you feel good to the exclusion of stepping on your toes when you need to have your toes stepped on, a religion of, you know, quote-unquote good enough, red flag. And you can find a lot of those religious groups out there, a lot of religious denominations. In some ways, even another lesson, like with Paul, you know, being zealous is good, in his case, Galatians 1:14, for the traditions of his fathers. And there's a lesson there for us as well. When we start defending our tradition, because it's our tradition, or because we're used to it, or because the parents did it, etc., and not by appealing to scriptures, okay, we've got a problem there. Even when we say, well, we've got this tradition, let's go over here and look to the scriptures to see where we can find it. Hold on. You're coming in with the wrong approach, the wrong attitude. It's like, okay, let's go to the scriptures, see what they say. Okay, let's go do that. And whether we did it before, whether we've done it for a long period of time, yeah, that's secondary. The other thing, which I mentioned earlier, when religious changes, quote-unquote innovations, quote-unquote improvements, not really improvements, anyway, contrary to the word of God, multi-generational influence. Now, if you think in terms of Martin Luther, Lutheranism, 1500s, give or take, it's been around like now 500 years-ish, right? Lutheran, Methodist, Baptist, you name it, multi-hundreds of years. If you want to go back prior to that with, like, you know, Roman Catholicism, it's been around for, you know, 1,500, give or take, years. Multi-generational. In fact, as you read through the rest of the Old Testament, as they go through the different kings until the time in the future when these two worship centers are destroyed, one of the key descriptions of the kings is this. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin, setting up Dan and Bethel, etc. That was like almost a rubber stamp of, yeah, he continued it, he continued it, this other one continued it, etc. Bad news. It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Unfortunately. So that was around 960, again with Rehoboam, Jeroboam. So now we're going to advance forward to roughly 930 and King Asa. Interesting, and it's only one verse, which I found. Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 15. So recognizing that King Asa started out good, he was encouraged by the prophet Azariah, and as a result, he did even more good. So all that's definitely good. No problem with that. He had removed some of the altars, I think, prior to that encouragement. But after the encouragement, he, quote-unquote, took courage, according to 2 Chronicles 15, and started removing these idol altars and all the high places, you know, throughout the land. And if I remember correctly, it's like Judah, Benjamin, and even Ephraim, part of the territory that they had under their control at that time from the northern kingdom. Great. Okay. Keep going. Even to the point of removing his mother from the position of, quote-unquote, queen mother. She had her own idol. Now, I'm not exactly certain when she did that, but it seems a little odd that he would, like, you know, purge Jerusalem and Judea of the idols in this first pass, and she still had one. And then the prophet comes in and says, hey, you're doing a good job. Keep on doing it. The Lord promote you or whatever, favor you. And he says, okay, great. Now I'm going to go after the rest of the kingdom. And he looks in his own house and goes, oh, yeah, my mom. My mom's an idol worshiper. Demote her from her official position. Smashed her idol, etc. I don't have the verse. It's somewhere in there, roughly in the middle. Looks like the bottom of the chart got cut off. That's okay. We'll find it out real quick here for your... First King, not Second Chronicles, my apology. First Kings 12, verse 28. And if I remember right, I think it's in both accounts. I could be wrong on that. But for sure, 1 Kings 12, 28. Yeah, crushed her idol, etc. So, what can we learn from that? In terms of application? Well, first of all, we need to keep in mind we need to honor our parents. You know, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 2. And, you know, honor in terms of what honor is due. And yet, while still trying to honor, respect, etc. What does Luke 14, 26 say? And of course, this is in the context of serving God. If anyone comes to me, does not hate, as in love less than me, father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, etc., own life, he cannot be my disciple. And this is where things get kind of hard, quite frankly. Especially if you want to overlay that with Ephesians. I mean, you know, the center point is like, okay, so, you know, the family is coming from one religious background, and I've been now acquainted newly with you know, true Christianity, true Christ, baptism, etc. And so I have to choose between my family and this quote-unquote new religion, which is not necessarily new, but true. Okay, got to make a choice here. Okay, well, Luke 14 says, go with what's true. But even more so, and when things get real dicey, particularly in the case of Asa, Ephesians 5:11, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. Even if it's only our own family members? Well, yeah. I mean, we have the example of Asa doing exactly that. And probably somewhat painful for him to, you know, take his mom and go, Mom, sorry, can't be the queen mother. I don't know what that involved, but it's like, oh yeah, and this devoted thing that you've been, you know, set up and worshiping and whatever, it's like, in his particular case, like, no, we're not going to tolerate that. Family ties. Got to be careful about those. So that's around 930. Next up, we're going to go around 870, give or take, with Jehoshaphat, Ahab, and Jezebel. Of course, we've got those names across here. Jehoshaphat, Jezebel, Ahab. And we're going to see some interaction now between the two, the southern and the northern, kind of like we were seeing up here between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Okay, let's talk about a worthy woman. Not Jezebel. 1 Kings 16 through 21, give or take. Of course, she was the wife of King Ahab, King Ahab being a king over the northern kingdom, daughter of a Sidonian king, of course, non-Jewish, foreign woman, idol worshiper, Baal in this case, very much Baal worshiper, as we find. And of course, that just flies in the face of what Moses said, Exodus 32:16. It flies in the face of Solomon's experience in 1 Kings 11. Of course, what are we talking about? Solomon around 950, so maybe 100 years previously. And people, I don't know, had forgotten what Solomon had done in the latter part of his life. So Ahab, yeah, marries her. And what happens as a result? Well, in many ways, she uses her position of authority as queen, right? Killing the prophets of God, 1 Kings 18. Threatening Elijah with killing him, 1 Kings 19. Murdering Naboth, remember the Naboth in his vineyard? 1 Kings 21, etc. A very strong influence for her husband and the whole nation for evil. As the quote on the bottom of the screen says, 1 Kings 21:25, no one like Ahab, of course it starts off with Ahab, who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord. There's not a period there, is there? There's a comma, right? Comma! Because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up. Can we learn a lesson there? Well, we better. For single people, yeah, better. You know, in terms of selecting friends, dating, falling in love, marriage, you better learn that lesson. Proverbs 31, 10 through 31, in contrast, the true worthy woman, virtuous woman, depending on your translation. Beware of, subtly pulling the strings, so to speak, behind the scenes for evil. In fact, and I'm not certain how far to go with this, her name, I think, somewhat synonymous with quote-unquote spiritual seduction. Revelation chapter 2, verse 20. I don't know if they really had a woman there called Jezebel. You would tend to think not, given historical association, connotations with that name. Maybe there was. I don't know. But even in their case, calls herself a prophetess, teaches to seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality, eat things sacrificed to idols. Certainly sounds a lot like what was going on in the past. And likewise, lessons learned today, watch out for spiritual seduction as well. So not only, dating kind of situation, but also, congregational as well. That was number four, worthy woman, not Jezebel. Let's talk about Jehoshaphat. Of course, king over Judah at this time. If you want to look at it, 2 Chronicles 17, give or take. Now, he's a righteous king, as described in 2 Chronicles 17, 3 through 6. Okay, got to grant him that. But he aligned himself by marriage with King Ahab, that we just got through talking about, right? King Ahab, Jezebel, etc. So a good king aligns himself with those guys in the northern kingdom. Not smart. 2 Chronicles 18, 1. In fact, he goes up and joins a fight with King Ahab against Syria. And you may recall, I think it was Micaiah, the prophet, said, don't do that. But he did anyway. I like this. Ahab says, hey, I tell you what, I got a deal for you. You wear your kingly robes in your chariot in the battle, and I'll disguise myself. And, okay, Jehoshaphat says, okay, sure, fine, why not? Duh. Anyway, so he goes off into battle. Regal chariot, regal robes, whatever. And the opposing king has told all of his people, okay, I only want you to focus, take out the head man. Right? Well, how do you find the head man and there's all this massive confusion of war and chariots and horses and whatever? Well, by the way, he's dressed. So who do they go after? Jehoshaphat. As a result, he's almost killed. Barely escapes. 2 Chronicles 18:31. The interesting thing, I thought, he didn't learn from this lesson at all. 2 Chronicles 20, verse 55, he forms another alliance with another northern kingdom king, who in many ways is just like Ahab. Didn't learn from his lesson. So, can we learn from that today? Well, sure. Let's talk about friends and friendship. Let's talk about, as the little graphic on the top says, birds of a feather flock together. You've heard that before. You know, classic verse, 1 Corinthians 15:33, do not be deceived, evil company, or companionships, depending on your translation, corrupts good habits. I like Job, a little snippet in Job 34:8. Travels in the company with evildoers, walks with wicked men. Now, they're not talking about taking a vacation. They're not talking about going to Disney World, right? They're talking about a manner of life, close association, close ongoing lifestyle, etc. So, don't be deceived, which implies you can be deceived. So don't be deceived. On an individual basis, okay? What about, though, in a broader basis with the world? Well, we've got that one covered as well, James 4:4. Do you not know that friendship with the world, enmity with God, if you really want to be a friend of the world, well, you're really making yourself an enemy of God. Because the morals, the patterns, the lifestyle, the speech, the entertainment, I mean, you name it, list it up, that in general the world wants to go after, and the same thing that God wants you to go after, generally speaking, are diametrically 180 degree opposite, opposed. I like the quote from Proverbs 13:20. And think in terms of Jehoshaphat, and think in terms of people today that want to say, well, yeah, I know my friends aren't the best friends, but they are my friends. Careful. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed. Let us keep that in mind. Okay. Might finish a little bit early tonight. Number 6, Jehoshaphat, same king. Okay. We go forward a little bit, 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Okay. So after the debacle with King Ahab, there is this great multitude, quote unquote, that's the word, in I think 2 Chronicles 20. Again, here they come again, surrounding nations, the Moabites, the Ammonites, etc. And they're coming to war. Okay. And Jehoshaphat is like, we would say, freaked out in terms of afraid. Now, what some of the other kings would do is they would get, and that kind of blows my mind, they would go into the temple, gather up the gold and silver, and throw in some of their own, of course, and go to one of the other surrounding nations, like Egypt or Syria or whatever, and hire them with money out of the treasury. That's where my mind is kind of fixed. Come join a league with us to go fight these other guys that are, you know, threatening us. No, he didn't do that. He turned his attention to seek the Lord, according to 2 Chronicles 20, verse 3. And as a result, the Lord delivered him. At that point in time, in a very miraculous way. Can we learn from that? Well, we better. When, you know, going gets tough, when you're surrounded by threatening circumstances or situations or adversity or, you know, fill in the blank, be anxious for nothing. This is from Philippians 4. But in everything by prayer, and if you'll notice the context of 2 Chronicles 20, you know, they were doing that, praying to the Lord. Prayer. Supplication, okay, got that. Whoa, with thanksgiving. So, and they did too. In the midst of all this, oh, we're about to be, you know, overcome by whatever, they're singing praises to God. In fact, they're going out into the battle. That, you know, battle hasn't been fought yet. Haven't encountered the enemy yet, but off they go. And they're singing praises to God and, you know, praising his greatness, etc. Almost like having that confidence that, yep, he said he'd take care of us. Okay, fine, let's go. And praise him while we go. And the peace of God, continuing on in Philippians chapter 4, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. That's comforting. Right? A lot of comfort there. You know, this is one of the good examples that we can learn from, that, you know, as someone once said, and it sounds kind of odd, but it makes sense, when the going gets tough, the tough get on their knees. In terms of prayer, and you may have heard that phrase, reaching out for help. Or there are times when, you know, it's outside of your control. It's pretty much outside of your influence. Sometimes you've got to let go and let God. I've heard that phrase too. I don't know if you can find that phrase in the Bible, but certainly the concept is. How about this one? 1 Peter 3, verse 12. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. So you have that promise. Promise that he's listening. Promise that, you know, with prayer, supplication, and thanksgiving, we have a promise of peace guarding our hearts and minds. In fact, 2 Chronicles 20, verse 21. Put your trust in the Lord your God, and you will be established. Give thanks to the Lord, for his loving kindness is everlasting. And at least in this manner, this way, the God back then, same God as today. Right. Now, miraculous, okay, we can talk about that then, not now. But in terms of, you know, loving kindness, etc. Yep, valid for today. All right, we've done a little bit early tonight. So, we're going to stop here. Let you go home a little bit early. So what kind of conclusions can we draw from what we've seen in this limited sample of about six tonight? Well, seeking counsel from wise sources, right? Not necessarily your buddies, don't take offense, please, who are as relatively young and immature, perhaps, as you are. Or worldly friends who have a worldly mindset. Okay? Be careful. Wise counsel. So, counsel from wise sources, I should say. Religious quote-unquote improvements often aren't. I say often. Should I say almost always? I mean, if it's not in the scriptures, it's not. How's that? Let's just draw that line. How about loving God more than family? That's a good lesson to learn. And again, be careful who your friends are. Including, or maybe I should say especially, who you date and quote-unquote, and I don't like this phrase, but it's very common, quote-unquote, fall in love with. Of course, that implies the Calvin equivalent of irresistible grace. Well, I just fell in love. I just tripped and I fell. Gravity just, And, you let yourself. Again, it implies, no control, which shouldn't be the case at all. And, of course, reach out to God in good times via prayer. I said that wrong. Reach out to God in bad times and in good as well. And, of course, one of the verses we had at the very beginning when we started, now these things happen to them as an example, but they are written down for our instruction. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. So there you go. If there is a next time, we'll continue with this pattern. I think the next one is a big chart. Yeah. So if there is a next time, we'll kind of continue on down the timeline. I've got some other, various kings. I think the very last one I've got down here is some with the Babylonian captivity. So again, kind of a historical overview as well as learning what we can to be more faithful in various situations. Time for the invitation. So if you want to open songbooks, number 329... Of course, what is an invitation but God calling? Right. In some ways we can make this very simple. You know who you are. If you feel the need to become a Christian, if you feel the need to be restored as a Christian with public confession of public sin, if you need the prayers of the congregation for help and assistance, you know who you are. You have the opportunity to respond coming forward as we stand in sin.